It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
About a year ago, you could go on the internet and you could bid on defaulted credit card debt where the entire pool of debt that you were buying is stipulated to be outside the statute of limitations.
Private attorney Tom Domonoski reveals the shocking and shady world of debt buyers. And if a debt collector says that unless you pay, he'll turn in a Form 1099 to the IRS, you'll learn whether that's a serious concern or an empty threat during this week's question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 112, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. It's the new year, and everyone's tax cuts were extended, so nobody's taxes went up. Not quite. Almost completely unnoticed, 51 million lower-income people will do worse under the federal tax bill passed by Congress, according to Consumer Reports. The new law does not include an extension of the Making Work Pay tax credit, which in 2009 and 2010 provided a credit of up to $400 for individuals and $800 for families who are low and moderate income. Instead, the law creates a one-year reduction in Social Security payroll taxes. Although the $120 billion payroll tax reduction offers nearly twice the tax savings of the credit it replaces, nevertheless, it will lead to higher tax bills for individuals with incomes below $20,000 a year and for families who make less than $40,000 a year. This is because their payroll tax savings will be less than the $400 or $800 they will lose from the failure to extend the Making Work Pay tax credit. This results in a tax increase of a couple hundred dollars a year on the working poor. Yes, rather than increase taxes on the rich or the middle class, President Obama and the U.S. Congress compromised, and we are only increasing taxes on those least able to afford it. Americans hunger for bipartisan solutions, and we sure got one here. Happy New Year. In other news... Also last month, the House of Representatives blocked a last-minute effort to allow foreclosure prevention funds to go to legal aid societies, arguing it was an inappropriate use of financial rescue money. Lawmakers failed to pass a bill for legal aid to receive money through a federal program to assist homeowners on the verge of foreclosure. The Treasury Department allocated $7.6 billion to the Hardest Hit Fund, which uses money from the $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. But legal aid programs are not able to receive such assistance. Opponents said this was an attempt to bring the bailout back to life for the sole purpose of showering taxpayer money on community groups that provide legal assistance. But Representative Barney Frank, outgoing chair of the House Financial Services Committee, said recent revelations of sloppy foreclosure practices at large banks underscore the need for homeowners to receive professional legal assistance when facing foreclosure, and was appalled by the insensitivity and cruelty of the opposition, saying the bill did not extend the TARP in any way. The bill needed a two-thirds vote to pass because it was brought up under a special House procedure intended for uncontroversial issues. It fell short in a 210 to 145 vote, largely along party lines. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for the answer to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week, we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. What are the two ways an adoption can occur without a parent's consent? A. A court finds the adoption to be in the best interest of the child. B. The child was born out of marriage and the father is unknown or can't be found. Or C. The parental rights of a parent have been ended by a court. The correct answers are B. The child was born out of marriage and the father is unknown or can't be found. And C. The parental rights of a parent have been ended by a court. Unless parental rights have been terminated, an adoption can take place without the consent of a parent only if the court finds it is in the best interest of the child and that keeping the relationship between the parent and the child would be harmful. Later in the show, we'll give you this week's quiz. Is that legal? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time for this week's question and answer session. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Tell us your name and where you're from.
Debbie from Richmond, Virginia.
Welcome to the show, Debbie. What question do we have this week?
I got a phone call from someone that they were going to file a 1099-C if I didn't make a payment arrangement. I didn't know what that was, so I said, do whatever, but I just wondered what this was about.
Well, Debbie, that's a great question because this is a tactic that is becoming increasingly common among debt collectors to pressure people to pay debts that they shouldn't pay and possibly even don't owe. A creditor is required to file a Form 1099 with the Internal Revenue Service when, during a calendar year, it discharges or forgives a debt greater than or equal to $600, except when the discharge meets one of the exceptions that's in the IRS code. Now, those exceptions are so big that they pretty much swallow the rule. The Form 1099-C is sent to the IRS, and then the forgiven debt can be treated as taxable income that you have to pay tax upon. And, of course, that's going to cost you money, and that's why the debt collectors use it as a means of pressuring you to pay them rather than having to pay taxes. However, there are so many exceptions to it being counted as income that, as I said, they pretty much swallow the rule. Only the principal amount of the debt, not any interest, not any fees, are treated as income. And the reason for that is that interest and fees were never available to you. That was never money that you had to spend. Only the principal of the debt, the amount you actually borrowed, was money that you had to spend. And since you didn't pay it back because they forgave it, then that's the logic of treating it as income. However, debt that's been discharged, canceled or forgiven cannot be treated as taxable income, first of all, if the discharge occurs in a bankruptcy case. But the IRS code also excludes from gross income the discharge of any debt that occurs when the taxpayer is, quote, insolvent. The only limitation there is that the amount excluded can't exceed the amount by which the taxpayer is insolvent. Now, insolvent simply means that you add up all of what you own, and you subtract all of what you owe. If there's a surplus, if you own more than you owe, then you are not insolvent. If you owe more than you own, then you are insolvent. So if you're, you know, $40,000 in debt and you have, let's say, $2,000 in the bank, you're $38,000 insolvent. And if you're insolvent, then a forgiveness of debt through a Form 1099 cannot be treated as income. And that's what most debtors don't understand, that this really is an empty threat, because even if they turn in a 1099, it's not going to be treated as income if you are insolvent. And most people, I think, who are facing a 1099 are insolvent. Is this information helpful?
Yes, very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you for being on the show. If a lawyer presented a case in court without having the slightest idea whether the claim was valid, the lawyer wouldn't expect to win almost always. But it happens thousands of times a day across Virginia. Our guest, private attorney Tom Domonoske, reveals the shocking and shady world of debt buyers.
How would the judge react if a lawyer was in court with their toothbrush, brushing their teeth, and then saying, "Can I now spit on the desk, Your Honor, please?" The person may be well-dressed, they may have a tie on, and they may have even mistakenly been given a law license by the Virginia State Bar, but they are not acting the way lawyers act in court. When I go to court, I know that I am there to protect my client's interest, but I'm also an officer of the court. And as an officer of the court, I have certain obligations to the court, and one is to not present perjured evidence. That's like a really basic one. Another is to be honest with the court. And even before I get to court, my job as a lawyer is to be honest with my client. If my client comes to me and says, "I want you to sue that person over there," and I say, "Why?" and they say, "Oh, I just don't like them," you know, that's not going to be good enough. If the client comes in and says, "I want you to sue that person over there," and I say, "Why?" and the client says, "Because I want them to give me money," that's not good enough. Someone actually has to have what the law recognizes as a legal claim. And a real lawyer tells a client, "You don't have a claim." Part of this session is how debt collection lawyers are not real lawyers. They are going into court and they are bringing things that don't have a claim. And you're going to be the real lawyer in the situation. Except instead of talking to their client directly and saying, "You don't have a claim," you're just going to tell the judge, "Your Honor, they don't have a claim." And it is a huge, huge problem. And it is a huge problem because of how we sell debt in this country. You can go on the internet and you can bid on defaulted credit card debt. Now, I haven't looked in a while, but about a year ago, you could go on the internet and you could bid on defaulted credit card debt where the entire pool of debt that you were buying is stipulated to be outside the statute of limitations. So if you were a debt buyer in America, you can knowingly buy a whole portfolio of debt, being told that it's defaulted, it's unsecured, and it's outside the statute of limitations. Why would you buy that? You would buy that because you would pay 2 cents on the dollar for the value of that portfolio. And then you would try and take those debts and walk into court that you paid 2 cents on the dollar for and get a judge to say, "They're worth 100% of their value." And what they're really doing as a core business model is they're buying junk, and they're walking into court and they're trying to get a judge to take their junk and say, "Wow, that's an antique. That is really valuable." So that then their model, some of them, might be to sell the judgment. They might be just be intermediaries. They might be buying those debts to see what they can convert to judgments, and then they're going to sell someone the judgment. Because buying a judgment is a lot different. There's this huge industry. They are buying and selling debt, and then it's actually transpiring in the local courts on collection cases. And until that point of a defendant's lawyer coming in and going, "I just have a few questions," there has not been a real lawyer in that process looking to see whether that is a valid claim. I started as a legal aid lawyer in Farmville, Virginia in 1993. I came into that job with a public benefits background of doing food stamps, Medicaid, the Straight General Assistance, which is a California program for homeless people. I knew nothing about consumer issues. I wasn't given a caseload of representing homeless people because there just weren't that many homeless people in Farmville, Virginia. But I was given a caseload of people who were being sued on installment contracts. And I went and I started looking at the NCLC Truth in Lending Act manual. I kind of like numbers, formulas. And I started just reading the Truth in Lending Act manual that was put out by the NCLC. And now I get to stand in front of people and talk about NCLC materials. So, repairing a broken system. That's a great word, a broken system. Imagine you want to tell a judge truthfully that, Your Honor, this is a debt collection case. It's part of the debt collection industry. And this system is broken. The judge might think you're being hyperbolic. The judge might think that you're being a little irrational. Surely it's not broken. And this is a report by the Federal Trade Commission from July of 2010, when they held a series of workshops around the country. And when they were done with those workshops, they produced a report called Repairing a Broken System. And they talk about it. They talk about how the industry works. Initially had reports from 2009. They started looking at the industry in 2009. They put out a report, and so many issues were raised from what they were looking at in 2009, they ran a whole other series of workshops in 2010. And this is what they recommended that states should do. And the reason they did that is because they don't want to pay to do it themselves. It's the federal government, but they want states to do this. States should consider adopting measures to make it more likely that consumers will defend in litigation. Because the main problem with these debts that are not factually supported with legal evidence that can make them really pass muster in court is they're going in as default judgments. The debtor's not there, and the district court judge has that stack of papers and just flips them, and the names are called and signs them. And what the FTC said is, well, we got to be sure people defend. And what they're really saying is there's not a lawyer looking at this process. We've got to be sure that people come in and defend so they get a lawyer so they start looking at the process. The next one, states should require collectors to put more information in their complaints. The Fairfax court system has a model. We're going to look at that for what they're doing there. But the problem is the debts are being filed with just bare allegations of the amounts owed, and there's not specific information so that there's not proof that it really is owed. And I like that one. States should make it less likely that collectors will sue on time-barred debts. And consumers will unknowingly waive statute of limitations defenses. Again, all they're really talking about in these recommendations is that there be a lawyer in the courtroom asking very basic questions about what's going on. This is a comprehensive report. And in your materials, it's got the website. It walks through how they held their workshops. This is extremely valuable if you can get FaceTime with your local judges, not in a case. But if you can get in front of your local judges and be sure they get this report, every judge I know of, when they've looked at this, they get offended. The judges realize that their courtroom is being used to validate something that is invalid. And when they get a report that says it's not just their courtroom, it's happening on a national scale, they get a really simple idea. And they go, I can't change what's going on a national scale. I can change what's going on in my courtroom. And when you get the judge to be the lawyer who stands in the courtroom and goes, I want to be sure this is done right, you have then helped every person who comes into that courtroom without a lawyer. And if you can't get the FaceTime with the judges outside of court, if you can't print this report out, get this report in their hand, then you've got to do it in your cases. And maybe you print this report out and maybe you make it an exhibit. You try and get creative. But they need to know that it's happening in their courtroom and that it's happening everywhere and it's a system. And at that point, you have won 90% of what needs to be done, because then the judge can start doing it. Hidden in this report is just really clear, direct sentences that the FTC wrote. This this first paragraph talks about the function of debt collection complaints. Here's what a debt collection complaint should do. And then they did this nationwide study based on the evidence gathered, this isn't happening. And that's why they said the system's broken. It's easy to fix. You want to have a goal of getting your judges to require that complaints have the attachments to validate the debt. And by attachments to validate the debt, I'm not talking about an affidavit that simply makes some assertions. I'm talking about some records with an affidavit that validates the records. If the complaints had the documents to validate the debt, then a judge could look at them and see whether there's a problem. You could look at them when someone comes in and see what's going on, and then the system can start to be corrected. That will actually change how the debt buying industry works. If you can go buy a portfolio of debt, and when you buy a portfolio of debt, guess what you're going to get? You're going to get a CD. And that CD, depending on how much you paid, is going to have certain data fields. You're going to get a name. You're going to get an address. You're going to get an account balance. You'll probably get an interest rate, Social Security number, and there'll probably be some date in there that says the date that the account was last paid. That's if you pay the cheapest amount of money for the debt. When debt buyers buy debt, what they're actually doing is buying data. If they pay more money, they get more data. Why? Because if I'm selling a portfolio of debt, it's really expensive for me to take and get all the credit account statements, the original contract, the note history from all the interactions with the consumer over the telephone over the life of that credit card. It's much more expensive to get all that data together and put it on this CD than it is to put on this CD, here's the name, address, Social Security number, and amount that I say that person owes. So the debt buyers who are buying low are knowingly buying insufficient data. They don't have the account records. They don't have the account history. The reason they don't have it is they didn't buy it. And in fact, they might have bought something that said, we're not even warranting that the information on that disc is valid. There are some fascinating documents, and if you get into discovery, there's two things you really, really want to know. You want to know how much they paid for that debt. You want to get that number in front of the judge. Because they're in there saying, judge, I'm out of money. You know, that they owe $12,000. Well, if they only paid a cent on the dollar for $12,000, they're not out $12,000. The other thing that you want to find out is you want to find out the overall contract by which they bought that debt. You want to get the overall contract and see what it says. If the courts were doing this, which is requiring attachments, the debt buyers would have to buy those attachments to begin with. The creditors would have to collect them, and then the system can start to be repaired.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? We give you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which is incorrect, and we give the correct answers next week. If you're the first to email the two correct answers, we'll post your name on our show's website and send you a free copy of the Virginia State Bar's Handbook on Your Legal Rights and Responsibilities. Here's this week's question. Which two rules govern landlord access to rental property? A tenant cannot unreasonably withhold consent for a landlord to enter. B, a landlord can enter without the tenant's consent only in an emergency. Or C,
a landlord must give 24 hours advance notice in writing in order to enter. If you know the two correct answers, email them by Friday to marty@cvlas.org and be next week's winner. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. With Congress having just increased taxes on 51 million lower-income people, it's more important than ever that you know the tax laws. Join us next week when Paul Harrison from the Community Tax Law Project offers tax tips for the 2010 tax year and for your income tax filing due April 15, 2011. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.